There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com. This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abuhul, Annabelle Corton, and the rest of the team, only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm Annabelle, with me in the studio, my co-host Penny McKenzie, and our guest Alex McNabb, who's lurking in the corner. We've talked about Trump and scary musicals, and now it's time to find out what's going on around town in the arts and culture scene.
Book News, your latest literary roundup.
So, first of all, what's going on at the Emirates Literature Foundation? So, if you like a good book club, I've got two picks for you this month. So, first of all, we've got on Monday the 11th of November from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Sofitel Dubai Jumeirah Beach, something called Reader's Majlis. Now, the way this book club works is everybody brings a different book relating to a particular theme. So, that's a nice one. If you don't all want to read the same book, if you do want to read the same book and all argue about exactly the same thing, then Festival Book Club is meeting on the 20th September, that's a Wednesday, in the evening from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Now, the book being discussed there is Home Fire by Man Booker International Longlist author Camilla Shamsi. So what else is happening, Penny, that we can go along to?
Well, am I allowed to sort of like plug my own hobby?
Yeah, go for it. I'll let it slide.
Well, DDG, which is the Dubai Drama Group, which is the oldest drama group in Dubai, having been around for about over 30 years, is putting on Nora and Delia Ephron's collection of vignettes, which is Love, Loss and What I Wore, which is based on a book called Love, Loss and What I Wore. So it's a collection of, I would say, about 27 monologues and duologues. I've got an amazing cast that are going to be performing, all women. So if you want to come along and see that, it's at the Courtyard Playhouse from the 7th to the 9th of September. There are five performances. You don't want to miss it. I promise it'll be good. The other productive theatre companies around town are also really busy. This year, the theatre, the season has kicked off about a month early. So H72 Productions will be putting on 12 Angry Men between the 14th and the 16th
of September.
I love 12 Angry
Men.
And this is the original with all the men rather than women and men together, yeah, in the jury. And that will be on at the Junction, as I said, between the, 14th and 16th of September. Orb Theatrics are also putting on a rather magnificent play called Agnes at the Junction. And that will be on the 29th and the 30th of September.
So there's a lot going on.
There is a huge amount going on.
So how much will tickets set us back for things like this?
Well, it depends on what you're going to go and see. If you're going to go to the Courtyard Playhouse, it's by it's sort of by an RSVP, and there isn't a charge for the tickets. If you're going to go and see Agnes, it will be, I think their tickets are usually in the region of 100 dirhams. I haven't printed that out, but usually either early bird is 80, and then if you go on the night.
So book tickets early, you can get them a lot cheaper.
Yeah, you can do. We've also got a bit of poetry happening in town. So Zaina Hashim Beck, who is one of our favourite Dubai poets, will be doing a poetry reading with her Louder Than Hearts, which is her latest collection, at Al-Sakal Avenue. They have had a collection going through the whole of summer of events related to things literary. And this, I think, is sort of like tailing at the end of it on the 13th of September. That would be really lovely, I think, to go along and listen to.
It's a couple of really jam-packed weeks.
Oh, yeah, and we haven't even touched on the opera. I mean, there's Mozart all over the place and going on at the opera for anybody who's interested as well. We are really busy. I have a little bit of a favourite that's going to be on in the opera, which is there is a South African artist who's going to be performing at the opera. He's doing a farewell tour. So that will be really great for all the South Africans out there who want to catch one of their favourite artists.
Is there something that we can do locally in the way of a book swap?
There is. Now, that is an interesting thing to ask, but there's quite a few places that you can do. But the most recent one that is offering a book swap is in I've now lost my piece of little paper where I'd written all my
because
notes
we can't
down.
Always, you know, I love going and buying books, but sometimes you really just have to say no and walk away and just, you know, go to the library, swap with somebody. I think there's a place in
if
Media
you,
City.
If you're having, look, if you're sitting around and you're in a coffee shop, particularly Media City, they've got the Urban Bistro there, which is a really great little spot for stopping off and having a cup of coffee. They've got a community library and they will happily give you a free coffee if you leave a book behind, which I think is a great idea.
Well, that's nice of them. Yeah. I wonder if you brought in like a big stack, whether they'd give you as much. I don't think it works that way.
I think that comes under chancing your luck. But you know, they do these kind of things periodically. They've also done other things where I've been there occasionally, and if you get there before a certain time, you get a free cup of coffee. Yeah. I mean, they're not running that promotion at the moment, but they do interesting things like that.
I think
that.
It's why it's good to be like follow literary arts places on social medias, because they often randomly do these sorts of things, not just at Urban Bistro but all around Dubai. You just have to keep an eye out for them, really. I have some news, some international news, not local news, but it's very sad news, and it relates to Terry Pratchett. Do you want to hear what that is?
I don't know that I do, because if it's going to be bad news, go on, tell us.
It does get a little funny. Okay, so his unpublished novels have been steamrolled.
Yeah, you see, you should not have said that. You have crushed the hopes and dreams of many people.
Quite literally, they have been crushed. They were, as per his instructions, because he obviously passed away in March 2015, and 10 incomplete novels in a hard drive were flattened at the Great Dorset Steam Fair. And he wrote over 70 books to Terry Pratchett. When they did this horrible, horrible act, the curator of Salisbury Museum said the steamroller totally annihilated the stone blocks underneath, but the hard drive survived better than expected, so we put in a stone crusher afterwards, which I think probably finally did it in.
That's just evil.
I feel like that was trying to tell them something, though.
Do you know, had they not heard of the cloud, this is not gone. Somebody has got something somewhere. Come
Google
on.
Google will have backed it up.
Yeah, yeah. They just
but he didn't want his unpublished works to be completed by someone else, and I do understand that.
But he wrote so many books with other authors, I don't understand why he would feel
but
that
But he wouldn't
way.
Have had any say in it if he wasn't alive to kind of look at what work they were doing.
I suppose it comes to that whole Harper Lee thing with her second book. That was
the author that springs to mind in terms of finishing somebody's work after they've gone is actually Piers Tordé. You remember Paul Tordé wrote The Death of an Owl, and he got about two-thirds or halfway through. And his son, who came to the festival this year, Piers Tordé, actually found it and said, OK, I've got enough here to finish it. So he finished it. And obviously there were critics saying, well, what gives you the right to finish it?
But you couldn't tell. I mean, I read that book and at no point did I feel...
I thought it was seamless.
Yeah, I didn't.
I thought plot-wise you could tell when it was him writing it. But I think in terms of style and language, he did a very good job. So yeah, that's book news for today. Terry Pratchett's unpublished novels have been steamrolled.
And now for something completely different.
And that's something different is Book of the Week.
Book of the Week, what you should be reading.
So, Penny, who do we have joining us in the studio for Book of the Week?
Well, he's been in the studio for quite some time.
Lurking.
We've got Alex McNabb with us. And we've been reviewing our Book of the Week. I think all of us have read it for a change. Everybody's read the book?
Yes.
An American War, a novel by Omar al-Akkad. Is that how you would say it?
I think so. I think that's as good a guess as any with the guest that we have in the studio today.
Yeah. I'm wondering if I should give a question out before we even start on this one.
I think we should.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to do a very easy question in that case. I'm going to ask you in advance, where does the author live now?
And text in your answer to 4001 for a chance to win a copy of American War by Omar al-Akkad, which is what we'll be talking about right now.
And also, you can't say that he lives with his wife in the woods.
Yeah, that's very creepily included in the biography at the beginning of the book.
It is. Well, you don't know if it's creepy or if it's just giving up on life and running away from the world.
We've decided to leave all of the people.
Alex, tell us a little bit about this book.
Where to start? I shall start at the beginning. The publisher, for some reason best known to themselves, has not published a Kindle edition of this book, so I couldn't download it to my Kindle, and that irritated me mightily. There's a strange typography throughout the book, and there's a page given over to the fact that it's set in Adobe Minion. There's a drop cap for each new chapter, there are capitals for the first 2 to 3 words of each section, and there's a very annoying glyph, which I simply couldn't reconcile. So all the time I read this book, the physical form of the book was actually an irritation to me, which to me smells of just bad publishing, and I haven't even started on the actual book itself yet. And then the first thing I saw was a prologue. Now, this is a totally personal thing. I happen not to like prologues.
Why?
They're a waste of time, and they're a waste particularly of my time. It's like getting into a car to test drive it, being taken 100 yards in first gear, and then forced to get out of it again.
But then why don't you just
pretend, just to get back into the car.
Why don't you just pretend that it's chapter one?
Oh, I could do. If I was a nicer person, if I was a more...
If you weren't Alex McNabb.
Yes, absolutely. If I was a more open and pleasant person, yeah, I probably would. I'd say, let's let that go. It's got a prologue, but I won't be irritated about it and mention it in the review. But there we have it. As for the rest of the book, yeah, fine.
Yeah, fine. Well, you said to me on the phone, you said that this was the book that we'd given you was the one that you didn't like the least.
Yes.
I got that the wrong way around.
No, that's good. I've got a terrible history of book reviews on Talking of Books. For some reason, I've always been given stinkers and had to come on the radio
Maybe
and say,
you're
this
the
one
stinker,
was a stinker.
Alex.
It could be that I'm the stinker. But for instance, I've just recommended 3 books earlier in the show, which I think are marvellous.
That were written a gazillion years ago. I'm just wondering whether
you like
that's
weighty
a show.
Oh, yes, I'm old-fashioned. Well, listen, I wanted to like American War.
Okay.
I wanted to like it because the author, Omar Al-Akkad, has done what many of us have set out to do, and that's find some way of doing to the American people what James Joyce said he was trying to do with Ulysses to the Irish people. And what Joyce said was, when a dog fouls the carpet, you rub its nose in it. That's what I'm doing with Ulysses to the Irish people. This book attempts to show the American people what it's like. I'll give you another way of looking at it. I went to Jordan on 10/11, and I saw the way that people looked at those images of those 2 aeroplanes slamming into the World Trade Center towers. Now, there was at the time a little trope that broke out that the Palestinian people were dancing in the street. They weren't. But there was a sense of, now you know what this feels like. Now you've experienced some of what you people have paid to have done to our people. And this book is trying to do that. It's trying to show Americans, look, you could be on the other end of this. You could be in a refugee camp. You could be having militiamen coming in and slaughter your family. You could be holed up at Guantanamo or Guantanamo. All of this is being done to Americans in this book. It's Al-Akkad's way of saying, this is what it feels like. This is what it's like. And I'm putting you through this experience.
Before we get deeper into the discussion of this book, well, actually, we can't, because I do think that we need to save those comments for when we come back. Stay tuned.
This is Talking of Books here on Dubai Eye 103.8. From Shakespeare to Tolstoy, Stephen King to Danielle Steele, this is Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8. Now, back to the team. Book of the Week, what you should be reading.
You're listening to Book of the Week on Talking of Books. My name's Annabelle, with me in the studio, Penny McKenzie and the wonderful Alex McNabb, reviewing American War by Omar Al-Akkad. To give you a taste of the book, here's a snazzy book trailer with commentary from the author himself, Omar Al-Akkad.
Nothing in this book hasn't happened. It just happened to other people and happened far away. And so my only intention was to create an environment where you could no longer say, well, this is all the way over there and will never affect me. American War is the story of the Second American Civil War, which takes place about 50 years from now. The federal government wants to ban the use of fossil fuels in part because of what climate change has done to the country. A few of the southern states decide to secede rather than go along with that prohibition. What follows is a conflict. The book follows the story of Surratt Chestnut, a child of the southern Louisiana coast. To me, her defining characteristic is this sort of fierce curiosity about the world around her, this very desperate desire to know as much as possible. And in a sense, her life story and the arc of her life is the way in which her desire to know is manipulated, both by people around her and by the effects of the war that she has to live within. I can absolutely see how people would see it as a cautionary tale. I would see the book itself as trying to predict how this goes. the descent into strife and the descent into the kind of injustices that we see during war is not something to which people in this part of the world are immune. My intention was to say, if this was happening here, you would become damaged the same way, you would become vengeful the same way. As this book comes out, we're having a serious debate about whether the most powerful nation on earth is descending into fascism. I didn't foresee that, but I could see how somebody looking at that situation would think, well, what comes next?
And that was Omar Al-Akkad talking about his book, American War, a novel. I'm going to ask you the question again for this section. It's, where does the author live now? Where does the author live now? And just SMS your answers to 4001. That's 4001 with your answers to where does the author Omar Al-Akkad live now? We've talked very little about this book. We need to do a little bit more on it. What are your sort of views on the genre, about the dystopian fiction?
It's introduced as dystopian. Is it really dystopian? I don't know. So Sarah T. Chestnut, her name's actually Sarah T. Chestnut, and she calls herself Sarat, lives with her family in what seems to me to be a container. For some reason, I had a vision of it as a container.
Someone it was, yeah.
Louisiana, yeah. In 2075, and her father goes to the northern states, which is a border, to get work. The global warming has raised the sea levels, so... And her world is a world where America has descended into civil war. There's been a plague that's killed 111 million Americans. The seas are lapping at the very door of their homes in Louisiana.
So the civil war started because of the global warming disagreement, didn't it? What was that about?
The whole thing about fossil fuels and so on. And then her father goes north to get work and is caught in a terrorist incident. And then it seems like the war is coming to them. So her mother flees with them and they end up in a refugee camp, where she descends into becoming effectively a terrorist herself. And all of the things that happen in this book, you could expect to happen because of what the author's trying to do. And I think it's just too blindingly obvious that I'm being taken on this journey by the author. And I didn't feel as if I was being subtly brought into this thing. I really feel I was being hammered with it. You know, this is what it feels like. This is what it's like for us. We've got refugee camps. We had Sabra. We had Chatilla. We had become daubed as terrorists because we tried to fight for our freedom against these forces. But actually, these things are all understandable. And that's pretty much what I got out of the book. I just felt it was being a bit heavy-handed. And I did feel that there was an error in that trying to teach a people who are flourishing that they might not flourish, I don't think is a way of winning them over. It's too confrontational. But what for me was the brilliant piece of publishing was publishing it this year, probably the one year in the last 100, apart from Nixon and Vietnam, where you could say that to the American people and they might listen, because Trump has knocked the stuffing out of everybody.
And it was published in April of this year, so the timing is good.
Yeah, I think even the author himself was surprised by the reaction it was getting and the timing involved here.
Well, this is something that I was thinking about, because it's kind of being touted as being literary fiction, and I didn't find it terribly literary. And I thought, is it because it speaks to people of a time, because people are nervous at the moment, and you know, this is what could possibly happen to you if you don't, you know, change the errors of your ways and get a grip?
Well, the interesting point that you made was that this is set, this is America in 2075, so that's the picture that it's painting. And the comment that you made earlier was that you don't think that is enough time for all of this
to happen. I don't have a problem with the timeline in terms of the environment and issues to do with climate change, but I do think that politically speaking, what happens globally in the world, there's not enough time for that to take place.
And then you have, of course, the emergence of the Middle Eastern Caliphate, known as the Bouazizi Empire. And Joe, the guy from the Bouazizi Empire, comes to meet our protagonist, and he's the cool guy in the suit who's helping her to fight for freedom. So, hello, it's the CIA done the other way around. Mohamed Bouazizi, of course, was the guy who set fire to himself in Tunisia and then sparked the Arab Spring. That's the reason for the Bouazizi Empire. There's a couple of in-jokes like that in there. In page 159, one of the characters pulls on an Orascom T-shirt, and Orascom is an Egyptian telco and communications company. So, ha-ha, got that in-joke. I have to say the book didn't do it for me.
But that was also establishing the fact that all of the aid that was coming to the camps came
from the Middle East.
The Middle East.
Again, it's that role reversal. So here we go, big role reversal. America, you could go as low as we are.
So it's not speculative and it's not dystopian and it's not literary.
Well, if literary fiction is calling the sun an egg yolk, yes, it's literary. But I mean, that use of blindingly obvious simile didn't do it for me either.
I don't think... I mean, I'm just trying to give it a frame of reference for listeners because, I mean, there's nothing... I don't think there's anything Orwellian about this at all. And it's not dystopian, and it's not this, and it's not that. I mean, what is it? Do we just... Is it in a different genre altogether? What would you say it is?
If you've read World War Z, for example, where you get the story told, as this is, by a couple of narrators and also through reports, then it's similar in that way. But there's a cracking pace that exists or needs to exist in a book of that sort. Because then it becomes kind of like a thriller with people rather than a situation, if you know what I mean. Mm. And it was just a little bit slow. I'm not saying that it didn't have pace. It had pace, but there were parts of it that were labored. And I'm not saying I didn't enjoy the book, but when you're told that it's going to be literary, I have a different expectation. If somebody says to me, "Read this book; it's entertaining and it's, you know, a good beach read," I look at it differently. So I think you have to market it in a way that is going to get the right sort of readership or the right attitude going into it.
I have to say I didn't approach it with a genre in mind. I probably wouldn't have put it down as literary fiction. But then I've never quite agreed with literary fiction as a genre anyway.
Why is that?
Arrogance. Just that, oh yes, and this is a work of literary fiction, you know. He's probably just producing populist stuff. Oh, come on. Really.
So you're of the opinion that there are good books and there are bad books?
Yeah.
End of. Okay, fair enough.
But you can read them all and enjoy them all. Do you know, literary fiction comes into play when you're doing something like studying. And then it's not so emotional, it's more analytical.
If a book is great, I mean, some of the greatest works of, let's say, literary fiction, doing Air Fingers, some of the great authors that have rolled out as that actually write for an average age of 11. They're not writing intentionally complex. What they're writing about is situations that strike a chord in all of us and that therefore have left hundreds, thousands, even millions of people saying, that book has changed me in some way. And this book didn't do that to me. I felt it was too obvious. I felt I was being lectured.
Okay. Well, we actually have Omar Elakhad talking about dystopian fiction himself, which might give us a few answers.
I have a strange relationship with the word dystopian. I mean, some of my favorite novels are classified as dystopian.
Yeah.
Sherlyn Hannahan's Tale and 1984, yeah. All far better books than anything I'll ever write in my life, but also have that label of dystopian. But in some cases, it feels like a cop-out label, mm-hmm. in the sense that if you describe something as dystopian, there's an implied distance.
Mm.
Like, oh, this is fictional. This isn't really going to happen. This is worse than the worst-case scenario. But most dystopian fiction to me is concerned with the present. It's not concerned with some faraway, terrible future. It's concerned with an extrapolation of what we're doing right now. So that was the sense of that was what was going through my head when I was writing American War, was this idea of a grotesque extrapolation of things that either have happened or are currently happening.
Why were you screwing up your face then, Alex?
I don't think dystopia is not set in time. I disagree with that. Dystopia is not about time. You can have a dystopia set in the far future, you can have a dystopia set in the far past, you can have a dystopia set in the present. It's not time-based.
And jumping between them with base jumps.
Yeah.
In an opera.
indeed you can. I mean, what is a dystopia? It's a warped version of our reality. And I think one of the issues here is that this warp of our reality is so far into the future and is so counter to our current perception of the nature of America as a state and a people and a unity that its basic premise is very difficult to stand up.
I do like the idea of what he's trying to do. I just, as I think you said it correctly, he's a little bit ham-fisted about it.
I admire what he's trying to do. What he's trying to do is an important thing to try and do. I think many more attempts should be had at doing it. But I agree with you. I think it was ham-fisted.
I think my favourite moments in the book were actually when it was dealing heavily with characters and the children in particular in the refugee camp. And I liked the gender issues that were coming through there, because Surratt is very much a tomboy, and she's the only female character that I could see that was challenging what society was expecting of her, even in that situation, even in 2075.
That was shocking to me, because it seemed in 2075 gender issues are a throwback to the 1950s.
Yeah.
I mean, at the beginning, they're living in this in this container. She doesn't work. The mother is, I mean, she seems like a really nice person, but she doesn't do anything. She has no agency. She lets things happen to her.
One other thing, it might be a small thing, but did you notice that all the girls wear dresses? And I thought that was quite bizarre, because surely if you're accepting aid clothing and charity clothing, you know, there's not a single woman in there that I recall wearing anything other than a sundress, which I thought was bizarre.
And then you have Sarat's own sense of self and her own relationships, which very, very, very late on in the book, it turns out that she's a tomboy for a reason. And I just thought, hang on a second, so all tomboys are? No, no. I don't think it dealt with gender issues particularly sensitively at all, actually.
Not sensitively, but I like the fact that they were there. Your comment about agency and Sarat's mother not having any agency because she doesn't work at the beginning. When she moved to the refugee camp, and that's why I like that section of the book.
Oh yes, then she does become. But how does that happen?
Yes, there are parts of the book that happen very, very suddenly. Suddenly she's the biggest aid worker in the camp.
You know,
suddenly the brother, yeah. Simon, who's a drooling idiot who has to have his head cut around a pudding basin, becomes the husband and father, and has ordinary conversations. There is some very... Go back to what I was saying about editing Beirut. Sometimes you see some cracks there where somebody has clearly took the building apart and put it back together again.
Mm. Yeah. No, I definitely saw that with the book. We need to come back to this conversation. Stay tuned. More book chat on Talking of Books.
Book of the Week. What you should be reading.
Welcome back to Talking of Books with me, Annabelle Corton, my co-host Penny McKenzie, and Alex McNabb. We are reviewing American War by Omar El-Akkad. If you'd like to win a copy of the book, the competition question is, where does the author Omar El-Akkad live now? Text in your answer to 4001. We'll announce the winners at the end of the show. And first of all, we were talking about American War, and we're talking about the fact that the second civil war in America has happened due to environmental clashes. So we've got one half of the United States that wants to reject fossil fuels, and then we've got the southern states that want to keep them for various reasons. Now, I think we've done a little bit of research on how this mirrors real life and real policies today. You've got some information about that, haven't you, Penny?
Yeah, so earlier on in the year, sort of like between May and January, Donald Trump's team, I suppose we could say.
His team
went into the Environmental Protection Agency website and removed data that is there to do with things to do with the environment.
Environmental records basically.
Really important records that have been kept for a long time, which is important for researchers and to make predictions, etc., etc. And as soon as this was discovered, a whole bunch of hackers got involved and have been, since that time, been downloading as much as they can and storing all of this information in other places so it's easily accessible. I tried to find out what comments there have been from the Trump administration about that, or if anything's been put on the Environmental Protection Agency website about this, and there you can't really tell. So I couldn't find an official comment saying no, we put it all back or anything like that. There were some graphs and bits and pieces, but I mean, I'm not a meteorologist or anything like that, so I don't, you know, I wouldn't know what's there or what's been taken away. But it's interesting that it's happened, and the book is set. It's good the way the book has been set. I think it's fairly accurate in terms of predictions of what might be happening
in terms of climate change.
In terms of climate change, the rising seas, and more importantly for the Middle East, the rising temperatures. That is the real problem for the Middle East, is the rising temperatures, not so much the rising seas. And we do have a clip that we can have a listen to. I think that's lined up for us. Have a listen to this.
All references to climate change are gone from the White House website. Trump has a war against facts.
So maybe we should hide him in a place he wouldn't look, like in an intelligence briefing.
We can't hide the facts. We need that information to build accurate climate models.
This public climate data is stored on federal websites like the EPA, NASA, and the Department of Energy. And climate scientists depend on it for all kinds of research. But now that Trump is in charge, these scientists are worried he's going to hide or destroy that data just because he's threatened to do exactly that.
Now that's just scary.
Isn't it just?
It is a bit, but I think that that's one little microcosmic piece of data in a much wider data set that's global. We do expect sea level rises of some 20 feet, I believe, by the end of the century at current rates, and that's assuming the decline is not exponential. So there's clearly a very real problem, and one of the things American war does do is attempt to highlight that problem. I think it's just one problem too many. You know, we're already looking at a really big and almost intractable problem, that of American views of the Middle East and the results of American involvement in the Middle East, and that in itself is a huge enough problem. Then we add climate change.
So he's trying to do too much.
I think there is too much, but there's no doubt that there's a very real issue there. And I think one of the things, and it's something I thought about doing a book around myself and have rejected as an idea, but somebody really could do it and could do it very well, is in 100 years the water levels are up, food security. Probably in the next 50 years, food security, I think, and food costs are going to be the biggest worries facing humanity in the developed world. And I think that there's a whole area around there about looking back to us today and how we would discard one finger of a Twix because we weren't hungry, and in 50 years' time, you'd probably kill for it because we're not going to have access to food resources because of these climate change issues. I think there's a dystopian novel that I would gladly buy and read.
If you were speaking of novels that are to do with what will happen in a few years because of climate change, that sort of environmental dystopia. It's got proper, I think it's cli-fi instead of sci-fi. Cli-fi.
Is that a new
it's
thing?
A thing.
Oh,
it's a
I
thing.
Love it. I love it.
Kim Stanley Robinson's book, which is focusing on what happens to the city of New York. It's called New York 2170, I believe. So if anybody wants to read something specifically cli-fi, a random recommendation for you. And now back to American War. Sorry. Diverting the conversation there. I do have a question about the way the book is written and put together, and that is the interludes of primary source text. So you've got your textbook excerpts, government reports, notebooks, letters, etc. I mean, did you find that enhanced the personal story of Surratt and her family, or did it get in the way for you?
Yeah, it was all done in sans serif font, so we'd know it wasn't that as part of the main text. They got in the way for me, and in the main I found I skimmed them because they merely made points that had already been made in the text.
Yeah,
I felt
Alex,
I enjoyed really knew
that. I actually like that. I like those pieces consolidating, and just confirming and giving me a bit of a break. And sometimes you sort of assume things. There was a bit of history that was put in, which wasn't in the body of the work, which I quite liked. Do you think maybe it is too simplistic? But I did appreciate that.
But then if he hadn't been trying to do too much, then he wouldn't have maybe needed all that.
I would have gladly taken them all out. I don't think the book would have suffered if they'd
gone
out.
No, it wouldn't have. It wouldn't have.
Your understanding of what has happened, your understanding of the history. And at no point, to his credit, at no point do you have that situation where somebody says, well, we have had a plague and 40 years of civil war, and now we are suffering from this. You don't have that sort of exposition going on. You didn't need those reinforcements of the history. I didn't feel.
But now we're talking about what we personally feel about it, but how do you think it's going to be received by the general populace?
I saw its Amazon site, and judging purely from the number of reviews on Amazon, which is not a good benchmark, but it has not been a massive all-out breakthrough hit. If somebody makes a film out of it, then maybe that'll do something. I don't know that somebody will, because I don't think America has an appetite for having fingers wagged at it.
I think it would make, I don't often say this about books, but I think it would make a great film, and I think it would translate better to film than it does in the book.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Yeah, but then it's the marketability of it. That's the other, you know, the other thing.
I think that more controversial things have been made into film. I'm optimistic, though. Maybe I'm a bit naive about this, though.
I mean, the fact that it's been picked up by a publisher like Picador and it has gone mainstream, then clearly there's enough of an appetite for people in America to do some navel-gazing. There's undoubtedly a lot of people in the States who do feel that the involvements in the Middle East haven't been particularly wonderful, and that there is a sense amongst many of the more sophisticated American people I've encountered in my time that they feel that the Middle East could have been better served. So, and that's the whole message in here. So there is a community that would be interested in it, without a doubt. Mm. I don't know if that community is big enough or influential enough. Would we rather see Hollywood superstars flying around the Burj Khalifa lobbing missiles at each other, or would we rather see a considered view of what the world were like if the tables were turned? It's the Tom Cruise stuff every day, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about the whole issue of what home means? Because that's sort of covered. People, you know, the whole idea that what is somebody who is a patriot, and what encompasses that? Because a lot of that is what that book is about. It's which side are you on? Are you a northerner? Are you a southerner? Whereas just a few years before, they were one, you know.
And then, yeah, if you are brought up in an environment of hopelessness and you take to violence, does that make you a terrorist or a freedom fighter? Which goes back to that, as I said, that the central theme to this, which is, I think, the good thing he's tried to do, is open up those themes to an American audience. And what I tried to do in some of my work, and Susanna Bulhawa and other writers have tried to do. So what makes a terrorist, what makes a freedom fighter? Is Sarat a terrorist? Or is she somebody whose life has just gone wrong, or somebody who's been taught into ways? I mean, she's effectively radicalized in the book. One of the things I thought was interesting about the book is it's 110% secular. Nobody in this book professes a religion. Nobody.
A couple of characters do. But it's not the focus, is it?
No.
Which I like.
It's an irritation almost.
Yeah, it gets in the way. I suppose that's one thing that you can say for it. Yes, he's trying to cover a lot of stuff, but he does omit some things, and I think that's one thing that makes the book stronger for it. There is sort of a focus on climate change. And other stuff does come into it, but at least it has some focus.
I didn't come out of the book feeling about Sarat. I think that's one of my problems with it. So instead of being in a deep sleep, it was more of a sort of fitful doze for me, which is why things like the glyph could shake me out of it so very simply. I didn't feel for her. I didn't like her. I didn't want to be her. I didn't hate her.
Just to clarify.
I liked her. I did actually like her. I thought it was unfortunate that she was stuck in this particular, in a book that was put this way. I did like her.
I liked her as a character, in the beginning anyway. And just to clarify that what Alex is talking about when he talks about this glyph, it's just a little squiggle in the book that appears in between a couple of paragraphs.
A little annoying, unexplained squiggle.
There's not much you can say to that, is there?
I tell you what I didn't understand. I didn't understand her motivation for doing what she does at the end of the book, which we can't say because it is really very much a giveaway. But I couldn't understand why she felt that that was her solution, unless it was just the brainwashing techniques that kind of kicked in.
Yeah,
I didn't get that either. And I know I've been very, very grumpy about it, and it's I sort of feel guilty and unfair because it's a book that does try to do something important.
It does.
So final thoughts and a rating out of 5 stars from everybody, starting with you, Alex.
That's me on the spot.
Yep.
Okay, 3.
3 out of 5, Penny?
Yeah, well, I'd be generous with a 3.
Okay, 3. 3 for me as well. I think it's a solid 3. Solid 3, everybody. So that's American War by Omar El-Akkad. If you'd like to win a copy of the book, text in. We'll be announcing the competition winners when we come back.
Book of the Week, what you should be reading. From Agatha Christie to Jeffrey Archer, we've got it covered. Talking of books, here on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello, welcome back to Talking of Books. I'm Annabelle, and with me in the studio is my co-host Penny McKenzie. Next up, we have got something called Literary Soundtrack, which is where we pick a song based on a work of literature. We want to see how many you know as well, so if you can even guess what we'll play today, it relates to a writer who died on today's date. We were talking about him earlier, so text into 4001 if you think you can guess it. But before we do that, we've got some competition winners to announce, don't we, Penny?
We do indeed. So in the earlier part of the show, we asked you, what do you call the person who draws or produces maps? And the answer to that, which we actually gave you very kindly, and some of you picked up on that, is a cartographer. And the winner is Lucille. So Lucille, you'll be getting a call from the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature offices. Our second question is, yeah, well done, Lucille. Our second question is, where does the author Omar El-Akkad live now? And the answer was Portland, Oregon. And well done, Rochelle. You will be getting a call from the offices, and you will be getting a copy of the book American War, a novel. Those are our quiz questions out of the way. Annabelle, come on, before we play this, have you got a couple of songs that you were thinking of?
Okay, so I think the one that everybody knows, when you try and think of a song based on a book, I think the first one that pops into anybody's head is Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really obvious one.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether you love it or hate it, I think it's a bit of a Marmite song.
I like it.
I think it's weird. I think you have to watch the video as well, because it is just so weird. You know, when she's doing all the dancing.
Yes, yes.
In the floaty white dress.
Yeah.
The other one, I think we both found it, but I'll let you talk about this one, because it was a real surprise, wasn't it? The Katy Perry song.
Yes, yeah. And the, okay, no one is ever going to guess what, shall we leave a little bit of time and let people try and guess and see what Katy Perry song is based on a book, and what book is it? Well, we might have to give it away. Hey?
Yeah, I mean, I would never have guessed it.
No. So what was it? Come on.
It was Firework, and and it was, she was inspired by Jack Kerouac's On the Road.
And I just don't get it. It's just too poppy.
Well, I suppose we could say loosely based. And that's the whole thing of literary soundtrack, is some of the songs that we talk about on here will be very, very loosely based on books, and some will be very, very close. I mean, like I was talking about earlier, George Orwell, 1984, Big Brother, both titles of songs. I mean, he was obsessed with 1984 by George Orwell, and that's why he wanted to make it into a musical. So some of that is very, very obvious. And then you've got the random ones like Katy Perry's Firework.
Well, my one that I kind of thought of, and this is really showing my age, was Neil Diamond singing Jonathan Livingston.
Oh my goodness.
And I thought, oh, I'm so glad Annabelle thought of this, because now I can listen to it again. I have a reason to.
But today we're going to be listening to something which, if you probably guessed, has something to do with J.R. Tolkien. And the Hobbit films, which is probably another series of films that Alex McNabb has not dared to watch, by Peter Jackson, have some wonderful music attached to them. So The Hobbit was split into three films, and The Desolation of Smaug, which was the second, had Ed Sheeran do a wonderful song called I See Fire. And throughout the song, you'll hear a lot of references to characters in The Hobbit. And it's just a wonderful song, and I hope you enjoy it. You won't hear from us after the song plays, so we're going to say goodbye now. Thank you so much for listening to Talking of Books. My name's Annabelle Courton, with me is Penny McKenzie. Have a great Saturday, and this is Ed Sheeran with I See Fire.
Oh, misty eye of the mountain below, keep careful watch of my brother's souls, and should the sky be filled with fire and smoke, keep watching over during sun. This is to end in fire, then we shall all burn together. Watch the flames climb high into the night, calling out, Father, oh, stand by, and we will watch the flames burn up and on the mountainside. High. We should die tonight, we should all die together. Raise a glass of wine for the last time, calling out, Father, oh, prepare as we will watch the flames burn up and on the mountainside. Desolation comes upon the sky. Now I see fire inside the mountain. I see fire burning the trees. And I see fire hollow in soul. I see fire. Did you remember me? Oh, should my people fold, and surely I'll do the same. Come finding mountain holes, we got too close to the flame, calling out, Father, fast, and we will watch the flames burn up and on the mountainside.
desolation comes upon the sky. Now I see fire inside the mountain. I see fire burning the trees. I see fire hollow in soul.
This is Talking of Books here on Dubai Eye 103.8.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.